A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about gloves. Not the metaphorical kind. Actual work gloves for gardening and moving. He grew up working summers in a family picture framing shop, handling glass panes and wooden pallets, and he's seen firsthand that wearing gloves isn't enough. You have to know what type. So the question is, if someone's doing a lot of DIY gardening and wants just a few pairs of quality gloves that won't disintegrate after one season, what do you recommend? And how do you take care of them so they actually last?
This is the kind of topic that sounds mundane until you realize how much bad advice is floating around. I went down a rabbit hole on this. The Wirecutter Guide alone runs through something like 30 pairs they tested over multiple seasons. Digging, pruning, hauling mulch, the whole thing. And their top pick keeps coming back to one model. The Atlas Nitrile Touch, specifically the 370 series.
Which looks like someone dipped a fabric glove in a bucket of blue.
That's exactly what it looks like, and that's exactly what it is. The palm and fingers are coated in nitrile, that's a synthetic rubber, and the back is a breathable nylon knit. The reason they keep winning these roundups isn't glamorous, it's fit. Most gardening gloves fit like oven mitts. The Atlas ones are snug through the fingers, which means you can actually pick up a seed or a small weed without taking them off. Bob Bila's testing team called out the same thing. Dexterity is the feature most people don't realize they need until they're trying to handle something delicate with what amounts to a leather boxing glove on their hand.
The first rule of glove buying is that if you can't pick up a dime while wearing them, you're going to hate them.
That's the rule. And most people buy gloves that are too big. They think large must be safer, and then they're fighting the glove the whole time. The Wirecutter piece specifically notes that the Atlas gloves run small. They recommend sizing up. I tried a pair of the 370 myself and had to go from medium to large, and I don't have particularly large hands. For reference, I'm a donkey.
So nitrile-dipped nylon is the gold standard for general gardening. What about when you're handling something nasty? Thorns, brambles, rose canes?
That's where you want leather. But not just any leather, goatskin. Goatskin is the sweet spot between toughness and flexibility. Cowhide is thicker and more puncture-resistant, but it's stiff. Pigskin gets soft when wet and then dries into cardboard. Goatskin contains lanolin naturally, which keeps it supple, and the grain structure is tighter than cowhide, so thorns are less likely to find a path through. The Family Handyman Guide specifically recommends goatskin for rose pruning, and that tracks with everything I've read. There's a reason welding gloves aren't goatskin. They don't need dexterity. But for gardening, goatskin is the move.
We've got two pairs so far. The blue nitrile dip ones for everyday dirt work, goatskin leather for thorns and rough stuff. Is there a third category worth having?
And this is where the picture framing shop experience Daniel mentioned becomes relevant. When you're handling glass, or wooden pallets, or anything with splinters and sharp edges, you want cut-resistant gloves. The ANSI ratings here matter. ANSI A1 through A9, with A1 being basically protects against paper cuts, and A9 being you can run a chainsaw over your hand and keep your fingers. For moving boxes and handling glass, you want something in the A3 to A5 range. That'll stop a box cutter, a stray shard of glass, or a splinter from a rough pallet. The material is typically high-performance polyethylene, HPPE, sometimes blended with fiberglass or steel filament.
The polyethylene of excellence.
It's basically the same polymer as a milk jug, but spun into fibers that are incredibly strong in tension. The same stuff that's in Dyneema and Spectra ropes. And here's the thing about cut-resistant gloves that most people don't realize. They're not stab-resistant. Cut resistance and puncture resistance are different tests. A glove that stops a razor blade might not stop a thorn or a nail. The ANSI puncture test is a separate rating, and most gardening gloves aren't even rated for it.
The cut resistant glove for moving glass is great, but don't assume it'll stop a rose thorn.
Different failure modes, as they say. Different what breaks.
There we go. Alright, so three pairs. Nitrile-dipped nylon for daily gardening, goatskin leather for thorns and heavy work, cut-resistant HPPE for moving and glass handling. That's the quiver. Now, the part of the prompt that actually interests me, care and feeding. Because Daniel's right, most people treat gloves like they're disposable, and then they're surprised when they're throwing out waterlogged rags by August.
The biggest killer of gardening gloves is leaving them wet. Not dirt, not abrasion, moisture. Nitrile gloves can handle getting wet while you're working, but if you ball them up damp and leave them in a bucket in the shed, two things happen. One, the fabric back, the nylon knit, starts to mildew. Two, the nitrile coating can actually start to delaminate from the fabric if it's repeatedly soaked and dried improperly. The wire cutter testing team explicitly recommends rinsing them off while you're still wearing them. Just hose your hands down, and then taking them off and laying them flat to dry. Not in direct sun, not on a radiator, just air dry.
Rinse them while they're on your hands. Like washing your hands with gloves on.
Which feels wrong the first time you do it, but it works. The dirt sluices off the nitrile coating, the water doesn't soak through to the fabric back if you're quick about it, and then you peel them off and they're mostly clean and not saturated. For leather gloves, the care is completely different. You do not rinse goatskin gloves. Water is the enemy. Leather gardening gloves need to be brushed off dry, get a stiff brush, knock the dirt off, and then conditioned occasionally with a leather balm or mink oil. Not too often, maybe once or twice a season. Over-conditioning makes them greasy and actually attracts dirt.
The cut-resistant gloves.
Those are the easiest. Machine washable, cold water, air dry. The HPPE fibers don't absorb water, so they don't mildew, and the coatings, if they have any, are usually polyurethane or nitrile dots on the palm, which hold up fine to washing. The one thing you don't do is use fabric softener. It coats the fibers and reduces the cut resistance. There was actually a study on this. I want to say, out of a textile lab in North Carolina, that showed fabric softener can reduce cut resistance by up to 15% because it lubricates the fibers and lets them slide past each other instead of gripping the blade.
15% from fabric softener. So the glove equivalent of putting armor on and then greasing it up.
That's the image. Lubricating your own armor.
I want to go back to the leather thing for a second, because I think there's a misconception here. People buy leather gloves thinking leather is tough, leather lasts forever, and then they treat them like rubber gloves and destroy them in a month.
And the thing is, there are different grades of leather and work gloves, and most of what you find at the hardware store is split leather, which is the bottom layer of the hide after they slice off the top grain. Split leather is cheaper, it's fuzzy on both sides, and it soaks up water like a sponge. Top grain or full grain goatskin is what you want. It's more expensive, maybe $25 to $35 a pair instead of 12, but it'll last 3 seasons instead of 3 months. Bob Vila's guide specifically flags this: the grain quality matters more than the animal it came from. A good split cowhide will still fail faster than a mediocre top grain goatskin.
The $35 goatskin glove is actually cheaper per year than the $12 split leather glove you replace 3 times.
The Vimes Boots theory of socioeconomic glove purchasing.
I was waiting for the Pratchett reference. It was inevitable.
It's always there, lurking, but it's true. And the same logic applies to the nitrile gloves. The Atlas 370 runs about $8 to $10 a pair. The knockoffs at the dollar store? They'll last 2 weekends. The nitrile coating on cheap gloves is thinner, it's inconsistently applied, and the nylon knit is looser, which means dirt gets through to your skin and the glove stretches out of shape. The wire cutter testing found that the Atlas gloves lasted an entire season of heavy use. I'm talking daily gardening, not weekend puttering, and were still functional at the end. The cheap ones didn't make it a month.
We've established that quality gloves exist, that you want 3 types for the use case Daniel described, and that care is mostly about keeping them dry and occasionally conditioning the leather. But there's a question embedded in the prompt that I think is worth pulling out. He mentioned the picture framing shop. Glass, pallets, specific materials. Is there a material-specific glove logic that most people miss?
And this gets into something I find genuinely fascinating. The way different materials interact with glove coatings. Nitrile, for example, has excellent grip on dry surfaces, but gets slippery when it's wet. Latex, natural rubber, has better wet grip but degrades in sunlight and petroleum-based chemicals. Polyurethane is extremely grippy on dry, smooth surfaces like glass, which makes it the standard for electronics assembly and, relevantly, handling panes of glass. If you're moving glass sheets, you want a polyurethane-coated palm, not nitrile. the PU grabs the glass.
The picture framing shop should have had PU-coated gloves for handling the panes, not whatever cotton jersey things were probably lying around.
And for wooden pallets, the hazard isn't just splinters. It's also the fact that pallets are often treated with chemicals. Methyl bromide fumigation used to be standard, and while it's been largely phased out, you still encounter heat-treated pallets stamped with HT, and you don't know what's been spilled on them in transit. So a glove that's impermeable to chemicals, nitrile again, or a thicker latex matters if you're handling pallets all day. The cut resistance is for the splinters and nails. The chemical resistance is for the unknowns.
This is the part of the topic where I start to realize that people who work with their hands have a whole taxonomy of knowledge that never makes it into the consumer guides. The difference between PU and nitrile grip-on glass. That's the kind of thing you learn by dropping a pane of glass exactly once.
Never forgetting it. There's a whole world of industrial glove selection that's incredibly specific. Clean room gloves for semiconductor manufacturing. Cryogenic gloves for handling liquid nitrogen. Vibration dampening gloves for jackhammer operation. The ANSI standards alone, there are separate ratings for cut, puncture, abrasion, tear, impact, chemical permeation, thermal protection. It's a whole engineering discipline.
For the home gardener and occasional mover, we're not spessing a clean room. We're trying to avoid the bucket of mildewed cotton gloves that lives under every sink in America.
The glove graveyard. Every shed has one. And the thing is, the solution isn't more gloves, it's fewer better gloves and a system for taking care of them. The wire cutter piece has this throwaway line that stuck with me. They recommend hanging a simple hook or peg near where you take off your gardening shoes, so the gloves go up to dry immediately instead of getting tossed in a pile. That's it. That's the system.
The difference between a glove that lasts 2 years and a glove that lasts 2 months is a 50-cent hook.
The willingness to rinse them off while they're still on your hands. Which takes 15 seconds. The barrier isn't cost or effort, it's that nobody tells you to do it. The packaging doesn't say rinse while wearing. The garden center doesn't have a sign. It's one of those bits of folk knowledge that hasn't made the jump to common knowledge.
Like seasoning a cast iron pan. Obvious once you know. Completely opaque if nobody showed you.
And the parallel runs deeper. With cast iron, the care ritual becomes part of the satisfaction of owning it. Same thing with good gloves. When you brush the dirt off your goatskin gloves and work in a little leather balm, you're not just maintaining a tool. You're doing the thing that makes the tool last, and there's a quiet pleasure in that.
All right, let's get specific about recommendations. If someone walks into a store or opens a browser tab, what are they actually buying? You mentioned the Atlas Nitrile Touch 370.
That's the one. The Atlas Nitrile Touch Model 370. The palm and fingers are a medium-weight nitrile coating, not the thinnest they make, not the heaviest, and the back is a seamless nylon knit. They come in a bunch of colors, but the blue is the classic. They run about $8 to $10 a pair. If you want something a little lighter for detail work, the Atlas 350 has a thinner coating and even better dexterity, but it wears out faster. The 370 is the sweet spot.
The goat skin option.
There are a few contenders. The wire cutter recommends the Stonebreaker gloves. Those are goatskin with a reinforced palm and a gauntlet cuff that extends partway up the forearm, which is great for rose pruning. Bob Vila's guy likes the G&F products goatskin gloves, which are a bit more affordable and come in multi-packs. The key spec to look for is grain goatskin. Not split, not genuine leather, which is a legal term that means basically nothing.
Genuine leather being the natural flavors of the glove world.
That's exactly what it is. It means it contains leather. It could be bonded leather, which is leather dust glued to a fabric backing. It's the hot dog of materials.
The cut-resistant gloves for moving.
For moving and glass handling, look for ANSI cut level A3 to A5. A brand called No Cry makes a well-reviewed pair in that range. They're HPPE with a polyurethane palm coating, machine washable, about $15. DexFit also makes good ones. The key is to get something with a coated palm for grip. Pure knit gloves are cut, resistant, but you'll be dropping boxes all day because there's no friction.
We're at roughly $35 to $40 total for three pairs of gloves that cover basically everything Daniel's prompt describes. That's less than most people spend on a single pair of premium gardening gloves that turn out to be split leather with a fancy logo.
They'll last multiple seasons if you take care of them. Which brings us back to the hook. The Hook is the hero of this episode.
The Hook and the 15-second rinse. This is the most practical episode we've ever done. I feel like we should charge a consulting fee.
We're basically a home improvement show that got lost on the way to the studio.
Always have been. All right, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier. The difference between cut resistance and puncture resistance. Because I think that's the kind of distinction that sounds pedantic until you're pulling a rose thorn out of your palm through a glove you thought was protecting you.
It's not intuitive. People think this glove stops a knife, so it'll stop a thorn. But a thorn is a puncture hazard. It's a point load on a tiny area. A knife is a slice. It's a moving edge that needs to cut across fibers. The ANSI puncture test uses a completely different apparatus. A stylus with a specific tip geometry pushed straight into the material at a fixed speed. The cut test uses a blade drawn across the material under load. Different physics, different failure points.
Different what? Breaks.
There it is. So a glove that's rated A5 for cut might have no puncture rating at all. And vice versa. A thick leather glove that stops thorns beautifully will part like butter under a box cutter.
Which means, if you're doing both, say, clearing out a rose bed and then breaking down the cardboard boxes the new plants came in, you should probably switch gloves between tasks.
Or accept that one pair is a compromise. And this is where the nitrile-dipped gloves earn their keep again. The nitrile coating provides decent puncture resistance against small thorns, not blackberry canes, but your average rose thorn, while also giving you cut resistance against the kind of minor scrapes you get from stems and twigs. They're not rated for either in an ANSI sense, but in practice, they're the all-rounder.
The jack of all trades, master of none, but better than a master of one if you're only going to own one pair.
Which is why the Atlas 370 is the starting recommendation. If you only buy one pair, buy those. The goatskin and the cut-resistant are for when you know you're doing a specific task that the nitrile gloves aren't ideal for.
Let's talk about fit for a moment, because you mentioned the Atlas gloves run small, and I think glove sizing in general is a disaster. Nobody knows their glove size. It's not like shoes where you've been measured since childhood.
Glove sizing is measured around the palm, just below the knuckles, excluding the thumb, and most people have never done it. The Wire Cutter Guide has a sizing chart, and the Atlas gloves specifically. They recommend measuring your hand circumference and then going up a size from whatever the chart says. So if you measure 7.5 inches, which is typically a medium, you buy a large. The nylon knit has very little stretch, and the nitrile coating has none, so a glove that's too small is unusable.
A glove that's too large is dangerous, because you lose grip control.
And there's a specific failure mode with loose gloves and power tools that I feel compelled to mention. If you're using a drill or a saw and your glove is loose, the fabric can catch on the rotatey bit and pull your hand in. It's the same reason you don't wear loose sleeves around a lathe. Tight gloves are uncomfortable. Loose gloves are dangerous.
That's a sentence that could go on a poster. Tight gloves are uncomfortable. Loose gloves are dangerous.
The safety poster nobody asked for.
I'm visualizing it. Picture of a sad donkey with a mangled glove.
I'd pose for it.
All right, so we've covered the three pairs, the materials, the care, the fit. What about gloves for wet conditions? Because gardening doesn't stop when it's raining, and moving certainly doesn't.
Wet conditions change the equation completely. Nitrile is still your best bet for the coating. It's more chemically resistant than latex, and doesn't get as slick as polyurethane when wet. But the fabric back becomes a liability in sustained rain. If you're gardening in the wet, you want a fully coated glove, nitrile all the way around, not just the palm. The trade-off is breathability. Fully coated gloves don't breathe at all, so your hands sweat, and after a few hours, you're basically marinating. The solution is to have a second pair and rotate them. Wear one pair, swap to the dry pair when the first one gets clammy, hang the wet ones to dry.
The two-pair rotation system. Like rotating shoes so the leather can rest.
And it extends the life of both pairs because neither one stays wet long enough for mildew to take hold. For fully coated wet weather gloves, something like the Atlas 460, that's their fully nitrile coated model, or the Showa 370, which is a similar design from a Japanese manufacturer that gets very good reviews in the commercial fishing and agricultural space. The Showa gloves are actually the ones I'd recommend if you're doing serious wet weather work. They're about $12 a pair, and they're designed for commercial fishing crews, so they hold up to constant immersion.
Commercial fishing gloves for the home gardener. That's the kind of overkill I can get behind.
Buy the thing designed for the hardest use case, and it'll laugh at your weekend gardening. That's a general principle.
The buy once, cry once, school of tool purchasing, applied to gloves.
Although with gloves, even the expensive ones are cheap compared to most tools. The most expensive glove we've talked about is maybe $35. That's less than a dinner out, and it'll last years.
I think that's the thing that surprises people. The price difference between junk gloves and quality gloves is like $10 or $15. It's not $100. It's not a major investment decision. It's just knowing which ones to buy.
The knowledge is the bottleneck, not the money. Which is why we're here, I suppose.
That's the show. The Knowledge Bottleneck Removal Service.
We should put that on the website.
We have a website? All right, let's do a quick recap, because we've covered a lot of ground, and I want to make sure the listener walks away with something they can act on. Three pairs of gloves. Number one, Atlas Nitrile. Touch 370 for everyday gardening. Dirt, weeding, planting, general use. $8 to $10. Rinse them while wearing, hang to dry. Number two, Grain Goatskin Leather Gloves. Stonebreaker or GNF for thorns, brambles, heavy pruning. $25 to $35. Brush off dry. Condition with leather balm once or twice a season. Number 3. ANSI A. 3 to A5 cut resistant gloves with a coated palm. No cry or dex fit for moving, handling glass, pallets, anything with sharp edges. About $15. Machine wash cold, air dry, no fabric softener.
That's the list. And if you can only buy one pair, get the Atlas 370. If you're doing wet weather work, add a fully coated nitrile glove like the Showa 370 and rotate two pairs.
Don't forget the hook.
The hook is non-negotiable. 50 cents at any hardware store. Screw it into a stud near where you take your shoes off. Hang the gloves.
I feel like we should address one more thing before we wrap. The prompt mentions that most people treat gloves poorly and end up throwing out cheap, waterlogged ones. There's an environmental angle here that's worth naming. Disposable glove culture. Buying a 5-pack of cotton poly blend gloves at the dollar store every spring and tossing them every fall. That's a lot of landfill for something that could be avoided with a little upfront thought.
The nitrile on quality gloves is synthetic rubber, but it lasts long enough that you're not constantly discarding it. The cheap cotton gloves with the little PVC dots on the palm. Those dots are polyvinyl chloride, which is one of the least recyclable plastics we make, and they start shedding microplastics the first time you use them. The environmental calculus is straightforward. Buy fewer gloves, make them last longer, and when they finally do wear out, at least you've gotten years out of them instead of weeks.
Years instead of weeks. That's the whole thing, in four words.
It's also worth mentioning that some of the higher-end glove manufacturers are starting to think about end of life. Atlas has a recycling program in some markets. You can send back worn-out gloves and they'll grind them down for use in other products. It's not widespread yet, but it's the direction things are moving.
The glove circular economy. I didn't have that on my bingo card for today.
Nobody ever does. But it exists. There's a company in the Netherlands called Circular Glove that's built an entire business around recycling nitrile and latex gloves from industrial users. Hospitals, labs, clean rooms. They collect used gloves by the ton and turn them into rubber matting and playground surfaces.
Playground surfaces made from old gloves. That's either delightful or dystopian. And I can't decide which.
A little of both. But better than the landfill.
All right. I think we've done justice to this prompt. We've got the recommendations, the care instructions, the material science, the safety distinctions, and a brief detour into the Dutch glove recycling industry. I'm satisfied.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1900s, explorers on Sakhalin Island discovered a species of cave-dwelling amphipod that grows to only 3 millimeters long, roughly the thickness of 2 stacked Soviet Kopeck coins from the same era.
As right?
If you want more episodes like this one, and we assume you do, since you made it this far, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or search My Weird Prompts on Spotify. Leave a review if you're feeling generous. It helps other people find the show, and it makes our producer Hilbert Flumingtop very happy.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Hang your gloves up.
On a hook.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.